headline, a senior aide to Iran's leader hails a stance as adopted by Iraq's top Shia cleric in his recent meeting with Pope Francis. Human rights groups say the Bahraini forces have tortured children arrested last month during anti-government protests. The British Prime Minister has rejected accusations of vaccine nationalism amid a deepening row with the European Union over COVID-19 vaccine exports. Hello everyone and very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, an aide to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has hailed the stance of Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, during a recent meeting with Pope Francis. Mohsen Qoumi, the deputy head for Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's Office on International Affairs, said issues raised by Sistani were commendable and an honor for the Islamic world. He said the meeting will help boost cooperation between Islam and Christianity. Qoumi added that Sistani's emphasis on aspects, including the occupation of Palestine, was actually his rejection of the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. A statement released by Sistani's office said the cleric underlined the need to address the plight of Palestinians at the hands of Israel. He also expressed his outright rejection of sanctions. The Pope concluded his four-day trip to Iraq on Monday. Iran's president has slammed the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal for failing to comply with their obligations under the agreement. Hassan Rouhani made the remark in a phone call with the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Now, Rouhani also touched upon the impacts of U.S. sanctions amid the coronavirus pandemic. He said sanctions have doubled the problems of coronavirus patients in Iran. He added that U.S. has not taken any practical measures to revive the nuclear pact. The Iranian president described Washington as the biggest violator of the agreement. The British premier, for his part, said his country, along with the remaining signatories, want to preserve the deal.
Iran and the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden remain in a standoff over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The U.S. says Iran must take the first step and return to full compliance with the deal, but Tehran says Washington must do so because former President Donald Trump unilaterally walked away from the accord in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions.
Since the U.S. backed out of the deal, it should take the first step. The one that broke the deal must return to it sooner and knows that Iran is ready to fulfill its commitments.
Iran, which began scaling down its JCPOA commitments 1 year after Washington's withdrawal, says its measures are in line with two paragraphs of the accord and in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their obligations. On Wednesday, top Iranian security sources ruled out a step-by-step return to the deal, reiterating that Tehran will hold talks with the U.S. only if it lifts its unilateral sanctions. Speaking to Press TV, they also stressed that Iran will fully resume its JCPOA obligations only after the U.S. removes its sanctions. Such a stance was the theme of the remarks made by Iran's leader during a speech last month. Ayatollah Khamenei also said during his February speech that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure over its nuclear program and could enrich uranium up to 60% purity if the country needed it. He, however, reiterated that the Islamic Republic will never seek nukes. Now, as Iranian officials say the ball is in the U.S. court on whether it wants to continue the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by the former administration or reverse the course. This also, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy.
A former Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency has dismissed as meaningless so-called step-by-step approach by Washington and Tehran to revive the nuclear deal.
What does a step-by-step mean? Because the sanctions are one, and you cannot find equivalent element in our obligations. What do they want? The whole sanctions should be removed, and then Iran, as our officials have clearly mentioned and informed, then Iran goes back to where we were. Of course, we have taken steps, gradual steps, after 1 year of strategic patience, from according to Article 36, then Iran goes back. It is very difficult to understand, comprehend what does a step-by-step means.
So Tanieh further said that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is continuing the policies of its predecessor against Iran. He added the U.S. is making a serious miscalculation if it intends to use a maximum pressure campaign as leverage against Iran. He said Washington's return to the deal does not require negotiations, and the U.S. and EU should not waste time with such propositions. Soltanieh, however, stressed that Iran is in no haste for the U.S. to rejoin the deal and has not rolled out a red carpet for it. The Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights has rejected as politicized a UN report on the home rights situation, the human rights situation in the country. Ali Bagheri Khani slammed the report presented at the UN Human Rights Council session on Tuesday, saying it had serious inconsistencies and false claims. In a letter to the UN chief, Bagheri Khani said the report lacks legitimacy as its compiler cannot observe the principles of neutrality, independence, and fairness. He also criticized the report for failing to address serious violations of rights of Iranians by the U.S. Bagheri Khani underlined that Washington's anti-Iran measures have made it difficult for the country to get even the most needed medicine. Washington claims that sanctions exempt drugs and basic medical equipment, but banking restrictions have hampered Iran's access to any of those things. Human rights groups have accused the Bahraini forces of torturing children arrested last month in connection with protests marking the 2011 uprising anniversary. In a joint statement, Human Rights Watch and the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy said detained children also were threatened with rape and electric shock. They blamed the kingdom's prosecutors and judges for enabling such abuse. The statement said police and prosecutors refused to allow parents or defense attorneys to be present during interrogations. According to the rights groups, judges also unnecessarily ordered their detention. They said four children are being tried as adults, including a 16-year-old with serious health problems. Bahrain's popular uprising began back in February of 2011. However, the Al-Khalifa regime has cracked down on protests, arresting, disappearing, injuring, and killing many demonstrators. Political commentator Saeed Shahabi says the Bahraini regime has no checks as it uses torture to silence dissent.
It is clear that the regime is very sensitive to the idea of public expression of opinion. They don't want to hear anybody asking for anything. We are dealing with a regime that has absolutely no bounds, no constitutional reference, no ethical or moral stance, and it is just torture upon torture upon torture until they think they bring everybody to their knees. Well, I think the Saudis, the Emiratis, and the Khalifis of Bahrain, they have unified their forces. They have decided to go to normalize their relations with Israel. And the four of them, they are forming the Counter-Revolution Alliance, whose main mission is to crush the people, the Arab people. Bahraini people are among those who are affected directly by this unholy alliance.
Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has accused the United Nations and the West of having a hypocritical approach when it comes to Yemen. Abdul Malik Badreddin al-Houthi said that Washington and its allies are always quiet when the people of Yemen are killed with weapons that they supply to some Arab regimes. He said, however, that those very countries express concern when the Yemeni army is close to liberating Ma'arib from Saudi-backed mercenaries. Houthi said the offensive on Ma'arib is aimed at deterring the enemies, which have been wreaking havoc and spilling the blood of innocent civilians for years. Ansarullah leaders also accused the U.S. of hatching plots to target his country, just like it did with Iraq and Afghanistan. He slammed Israel and the West for propagating Fatah theory terrorism with the aim of gaining control of the region. Meanwhile, hundreds of health facilities throughout Yemen are on the brink of collapse due to the Saudi blockade and lack of fuel. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusions has warned it can no longer store blood stocks. Our correspondent in Sana'a has your details.
Thousands of cancer patients in Yemen are in dire need of help. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion and Research says the blood stocks and components of concentrated red cells, fresh frozen plasma, and the platelets cannot be reserved anymore due to the lack of fuel.
We have entered the dangerous stage of the collapse of health centers across the country. Our branches in Hodeidah and LBB have stopped their operations, and the rest of the branches are about to stop. There is no justification for this blockade. The interruptions in the import of fuel mean the death of patients with kidney failure and chronic diseases.
The center provides services to hundreds of kidney failure patients and cancer patients, including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country. International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Several European countries have reported more coronavirus deaths and infections despite ongoing immunization campaign throughout the continent. Now, the UK has reported nearly 200 new deaths, bringing its total to nearly 125,000 fatalities. Europe's worst hit nations also reported nearly 6,000 new infections, pushing its overall caseload to over 4.2 million. Neighboring France also registered 264 new deaths Tuesday, taking its total deaths to over 89,500. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy recorded 332 deaths and over 22,000 cases over the last 24 hours. It has the second highest death toll in Europe after the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, the European Commission announced it will increase vaccine deliveries to tackle virus hotspots. Now, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has rejected European Union claims that London has imposed a ban on COVID vaccine exports.
Let me be clear, we have not blocked the export of a single COVID-19 vaccine or vaccine components. This pandemic has put us all on the same side in the battle for global health. We oppose vaccine nationalism in all its forms.
Johnson's comments came after London summoned an EU diplomat after European Council President said the UK and US had imposed an outright ban on the exports of vaccines produced there. And Britain also wrote to Charles Michel to protest his claim. Row is the latest in a series of vaccine spats since Britain fully completed its EU departure in January. EU maintains while it exports 30% of its vaccines that Britain has failed to publish any data for its own deliveries elsewhere. But the UK insists it's one of the leading donors to the World Health Organization's COVAX vaccination program. Catalonia's pro-independent civil society has protested a vote in the European Union Parliament to strip three Catalan MEPs of their immunity for prosecution. Now, the MEPs are wanted in Spain for organizing the 2017 illegal referendum on independence. Cusay Kedri reports out of Catalonia.
The EU Parliament vote to strip Catalonia MEPs of their immunity came as no surprise to politicians in Barcelona and Madrid. The vote, cast Monday and held secret until Tuesday morning, was backed by 400 European lawmakers. 248 voted against it and 45 abstained. The decision was welcome news for Spain, which is seeking the extradition of the former president of Catalonia and his aides for sedition and misuse of public funds.
The decision sends out three messages. First, an MEP cannot use their status to avoid appearing before court for possible breaches of national law. Second, this is evidence of the solidity of the rule of law in Spain and the respect for the Spanish justice system. And third, the problems in Catalonia must be resolved within Spain, not in Europe.
Catalonia's pro-independence civil society groups believe the decision is a major setback for European democratic institutions.
They should think more about what they are doing by covering the interests of the Spanish state, because they are undermining the ability of the European Union to lecture others in the world on fundamental rights.
The European Parliament argues the prosecution of Puigdemont and AIDS predates their entry to the Eurochamber, an argument that hardly resonates among the separatists, who point to the increasing support for their case among EU lawmakers.
The number of MEPs that feel uncomfortable with the current course of events with the Spanish government has almost tripled. And this is huge and speaks tons, speaks thousands of, on one hand, how the Spanish government is handling the situation, on how the European Commission is not handling the situation.
The European vote revealed deep divisions within the coalition government in Madrid after junior partner Podemos decided to vote against lifting the immunity for Puigdemont, Comín and Ponsatí. Puigdemont's lieutenant in Catalonia Monday noted that the strategy of the separatists to take the conflict to the world stage is beginning to bear fruit.
The internationalization of the repression of Catalan elected officials by the Spanish state is more relevant than ever before in the heart of Europe. We will see what precedent this case sets in EU courts and parliament.
As Spain mulls issuing new arrest warrants for the three Catalan MEPs, their defense team have vowed to take the case to the European justice.
All eyes are now on the European Court of Justice, where the next legal battle will play out, much to the discomfort of EU member states, which seem increasingly embroiled in the Catalan case for independence. Cusay Kedric, Barcelona.
And that's it for your news bulletin, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Many experts believe that convertible industries are the prerequisite for industrialization and food security. The highest rate of convertible industries is related to the agricultural sector. This sector plays a significant role in the process of production as it increases productivity and creates value added in production of the final product. Moreover, expansion of food industries in the provinces with potentials of agriculture, especially on borders, will boost job creation and exports to neighboring countries. Moving in this course with focusing on leap in production will bring about positive results in the economic growth as it will lead to flourishing of economy in macro scale. One of the important indices of agricultural and horticultural crops is the way of productivity. This shows that according to diverse products, how much of these products are capable of converting to packaging and conserve industries with long durability. Reinforcing this sector will not only enhance foreign exchange in exports sector, it will also make the country self-sufficient and secure in agricultural and food needs. For this reason, developed countries try to make the best use of technology to increase the share of industry and services to grow gross domestic production. The most advanced countries consider the development of agriculture as the complementary of industry. Regarding the role of agriculture in green economy, convertible industries play a key role in the development of Iran, and paying attention to this sector will contribute to the growth of agriculture and economy. With respect to shortage of water in many regions in Iran, this will lead to the increase of quality of products and higher value added will be gained. Apple, apricot, nectarine, almond, cherry, plum, and walnut are among the horticultural products that grow in various climates in Iran. For instance, the black grape of Sarvabad in Kurdistan province is a top brand which is cultivated completely by dry farming and has a high value. Each of the mentioned crops is capable of turning into food industries. Agricultural products enjoy two general features of being seasonal and decaying. These features cause risks for food security in the country as they cannot be available in all seasons of year. The scale of food security will increase in the country when people are able to get access to their desired products at any time, at any place, with suitable price. This will not be feasible except with development of food industries because it will promote the capacity of reprocession of agricultural products and will solve the problem of being seasonal. The convertible and complementary industries in agriculture will also reduce poverty and discrimination due to the spread of agriculture in rural areas. Agriculture is in fact one of the relative privileges in exports markets and plays a significant role in prosperity of exports and garnering foreign exchange. In view of this, converting agricultural crops into products with value added will both absorb more foreign exchanges and increase the durability of products in markets. This can turn agriculture into one of the most lucrative industries in economy. This trend will cause sustainable job creation in rural areas, will reverse migration from villages, and will increase food security. It will also contribute to the growth of gross domestic production, development of non-oil exports via creation of value added in raw agricultural crops, and strengthen food security. Generally speaking, convertible industries play a key role in the process of the country's development because through specialization of the products of this sector, productivity of agricultural crops will increase and will make agricultural activities more profitable. Eventually, agricultural and economic growth will be accelerated in the country. Convertible and complementary industries are so important that they rank second in the world in terms of vastness after heavy industries. According to statistical figures in Iran, food industries shape more than 85% of convertible and complementary industries in agriculture sector. Therefore, with respect to the direct and indirect effects of these industries in production and job creation, strengthening this sector will result in the growth and thriving of economy in general. Simply put, agriculture cannot be successful without the strengthening and balanced development of convertible industries. These industries are indeed the precursor of the strategy for industrialization. Hence, one of the important objectives of LEAP in production is the increase of food security in the country with reliance on production from domestic resources.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kazimiya and then later they were moved to Najaf and he studied in Najaf. And according to the teachers that we have heard from our teachers or the resources that we had, they have said like he became mujtahid at the age of 16 and he had the ijazah from Ayatollah Khoi.
When we look at his scientific activities, his scholarly books, we see that all of his ideas come from a very established foundation. And that systematic, planned, programmed system can also be observed and manifested in his political and social activities.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts, theories, and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers all across the nation of Islam. With me in the studio are two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Zazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. We want to discuss one of the most important theories of Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, titled as Mantaqatul Faraq. Sayyid Mohsen, Assalamu Alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum As-Salaam Wa Rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Dr. Reza Zadeh, Assalamu Alaikum, brother, welcome to
you. Wa Alaykum As-Salaam Wa Rahmatullah, good to be here.
So in our last episode, we give our dear listeners a background and introductory remarks regarding the concept of Mantaqat al-Faraq, we can say, as Sayyid Mohsen defined it, it is a scope of domain of religion in which the Islamic ruler has free hand or free powers in order to issue rulings based on the necessities and the circumstances of the day. Isn't it, Sayyid Mohsen?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it's not about the fatwa only. Obviously, the Islamic rulings that we know in today's world.
Okay.
The technical meaning that we know, we relate to, like, we go towards the fatwa of a mujtahid generally.
That's right.
Whereas here, which in Mandaqatul Faragh, it is about, you know, it's an Islamic country, because the rulings that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the laws that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent, it is in the form of halal, haram, it's forbidden or it's allowable.
Yes.
Mujtahid, when he comes and gives a fatwa, it's generally, it says, this action that you're doing on the basis of, for example, the verses and the narrations that I have, or even if he does not have, on the basis of the principles that he follows, he allows you either to do that or he forbids you.
That's right.
But he is not issuing any new rule. He is not bringing a new rule, like Allah said, haram al-riba. The riba is haram.
Yes.
It's not like that.
This is the main question regarding Mantaqatul Faragh. That some of the, we can say, the scholars who criticize Shahid Assad for their theory, they say that Mantaqatul Faragh is in contradiction with the theory that Islam is a comprehensive and complete religion, and we can say has been born for the people, we can say, till the day of judgment. What's your answer to that, Sayyid Mohsen?
Well, there is no contradiction in having the Mantaqatul Faragh as well. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as I think...
So if it is complete, what is the need to the freedom?
I think in the previous episode, in the previous session, Dr. Lirzadeh has mentioned this.
Yes.
That we have two types of rulings.
Mm-hmm.
One is specific, which is sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There are some which are not specified.
Okay.
Also, you know, when we are saying like an Islamic ruler can make new rules, it is the part that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because this Islam is a complete set of religion...
That's right.
He has sent it till Qiyamah. It has everything in it. Mantaqatul Faragh is also one part of this, in which Allah has given free hand, in some cases, to the ruler of Islamic Ummah, that in some cases, according to the circumstances, he can change the rulings. He can make a new rule, and after that, that rule can be voided.
Or it's better to say he can make new interpretations out of the rulings, isn't it?
It's not new out of rulings. It's just a new rule.
New rule.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
That interpretations from the ruling or interpretations are done by the mujtahideen maraji.
Oh.
That is fatwa.
Okay.
It's totally a new rule, a new law, which is maybe applicable at the time of this ruler, and maybe it is not applicable at the time of the next ruler.
Okay.
So he can dismiss the rule, he can bring a new rule according to the circumstances that
Or sometimes the new concepts, I mean, we can say, or the new developments come into the scene. For example, now we are living in the 21st century, new questions, new doubts, new phenomena come to the scene. So the Muslim ruler must have this power in order to answer them, in order to look at them, in order to, as you said, issue a ruling about them, isn't it?
Well, you're going towards the perspective of the mujtahid.
Okay, yes, I'm the early mujtahid-like.
Yes.
Now go to the...
It's all maraji. It's the duty of a mujtahid that a muqallid, with the circumstances, if there is anything which is related to himself individually. Because the examples that you're bringing, these are the individual example. That individual, according to circumstances, what he should do. Whereas when we are talking about the ruler, Islamic ruler, in the Mantaqatul Faragh, he is giving a new law, making a new law, as Allah made many laws. He has a free hand. In some cases, he has to make a law which the whole society, the ummah, is following, basically.
That's all right.
So main difference between the fatwa and the rule or the law that in the Mantaqatul Faragh a Muslim leader is making is between the action of individual and the whole ummah or society.
Okay, thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Dr. Razazadeh, but the idea and theory of Mantaqatul Faragh can be very much dangerous too. It could be like a knife in the hands of, I don't know.
Yeah.
For example, we could see some of the extremist groups nowadays who has selected caliphs for themselves, okay?
Right.
Like al-Baghdadi of ISIS, okay?
Right.
So he considered some freedom for himself.
Right.
He called himself the caliph of Muslims, killing here and there with massacre, you know, and going to the extreme And he considered such freedom for himself as the ruler of the Muslim lands in order to do so. So the potential, the power, the knowledge, and the capacity of the Muslim ruler is very important here, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, anything good in the hands of an improper person can be dangerous.
Okay.
So it's not the problem of that good thing. So this is a very general ruling that anything good, I mean, this does not have any exception. But what you say is very true in the sense of if this ruling, if this concept is being used by an unqualified person, it can be abused. This is why Shahid Sadr explains about the conditions of that. One very important condition is the person who has this freedom or this, let's say, this
power
in his hand is a jurist, is a qualified jurist, is a marja who is a ruler. Okay. Not any ruler and not any marja.
So it is not a ruler who is not a marja or a marja who is not a ruler.
In most cases, and that's the case. So the conditions are very vital to have in
very
mind.
Very good. Do you have any other conditions for us to enumerate? Or is this is the only?
Yeah, for example, another major condition is that in that free area, anything that that jurist ruler says should not have any contradiction with the fixed laws of Islam.
Oh.
So because, as I said, we have two different types.
Yes.
And you know, this is very, somehow, it sounds to be clear after this explanation by Shahid Sad, of course, not from the beginning, but you know, because we have two different types of phenomena in the world. One are, as I call them, the dynamic phenomena, or dynamic, I mean, the phenomena that have a dynamic nature.
Okay.
And the other type of phenomena and relationships or whatever we have in the world, including the relationships we have and the things that exist in the world, they have a fixed nature.
Okay.
For the fixed nature type of things, we have fixed rulings.
Mm-hmm.
But for the dynamic type of things, for the dynamic nature type of things, you know, the religion itself has given a type of freedom which is in the hand of the prophet, the infallible imams, or when at the time of the occultation, the jurist ruler. And this is the necessity of the universe, because there are dynamic things in the world.
That's
there are things
that
change.
Okay.
And when things change, they need new answers, new responses, new reactions.
Yes. Thank you much, Dr. Zazadeh, for a nice answer. Said Mohsen Naqvi, but it seems that the Muslim becomes a ruler over here must have a mastery over different sciences, knowledge, or at least he must benefit from, we can say, the ideas of many advisors around himself, isn't it? Because if you want to issue a new law, as you said, based on the conditions of the day, he has to, we can say, have this power in order to reason, deduct, we can say, new things and give the interpretation, isn't it?
That's true. Obviously, he has to be most knowledgeable, obviously, because he is running the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
He is running the whole ummah. And if I can just give you a couple of examples
it
becomes
examples.
Much more tangible for us.
Very good.
For example, you know, when we talk about the moon, the first moon of maybe month of Ramadan or Eid, we have a fight, obviously, dispute.
Yeah.
A marja says you cannot see the moon with any tools or any means, and you must see this
naked
with the naked eye. The other says like you can use telescope and all those. Now here, if the ruler of the Muslim Ummah comes and he says that when we announce everyone should celebrate Eid, for example, and he has his own reasons for that, obviously. And he says, for example, even if we see, and they like have different points, for example, either they're looking with the naked eye or with the telescope, no matter.
Yes.
But the day when they announce, when he announces as a Muslim ruler, the whole Muslim Ummah should follow him.
Okay.
That's one example.
Yeah.
There are other example we can give, like, you know, generally it was in regards to the Hajj. We have many like rulings from different maraje that there is one Amirul Hajj, a leader of Hajj, a leader of the people who goes to the Hajj pilgrimage.
That's right.
And that was like in the Mina, they should pray behind him the salat of the prayer of Dhuhr and Asr.
That's right.
And he was praying Dhuhr and Asr the way Shia does.
Okay.
Right after Dhuhr, praying Asr. Not yes. There is no, the gap between, yes. Like generally we have different timings.
Yes.
So this praying behind him, and it is necessary, it is something which is related to the government,
mm-hmm.
not the specific faqih, because some of the fuqaha said it is mustahab, some said no, it is wajib,
mm-hmm.
and there are different rulings.
Okay.
So in the fuqaha, there are different rulings, and
that's
it depends
right.
on the individuals, whether they follow that or not.
Okay.
But when it is applied as, a ruling as a governor or as a ruler,
a state ruler,
then
that's right.
a state ruler,
yes.
then the whole state should follow that
okay.
ruling.
Very good.
And it's an obligation even on the maraje.
That's all right.
They have to do that because he has
mm-hmm.
been given this free hand in
okay.
these cases. So these are some examples which is necessary. Like when we give these,
mm-hmm.
these examples, it becomes more tangible. For example,
right.
for zakat.
Yes.
Some of the fuqaha, they said it is mustahab to give to the faqih.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can they're the
yes.
Spendings like where you need to spend.
Yes.
You can give to fuqara, masakin,
yes,
ibn sabil. These
what?
Charity, the zakat
okay.
that you can give, the wajib zakat, they have obviously in the Quran, the verses of Quran has clearly said where you can spend this zakat.
Yes.
And some of them has said like it is mustahab. But if the ruler comes and says it is wajib to pay to the faqih,
mm-hmm.
to the government, to the wali faqih, for example, who is the ruler, then everyone must pay that zakat to him.
That's all right.
Now, it's an order from the government now. From the point of government, it is an obligation.
Okay.
And this comes under the area of mantaqatul faragh, the
mm-hmm.
power that has been given to this ruler.
That's all right.
Although, individually, my mujtahid has said it is mustahab.
Mm-hmm.
But because the ruler, who is faqih, and who is wali, and who is the representative of imam,
mm-hmm.
therefore, if he says it is wajib to give to him, I have to submit my zakat to
That's
him.
That's all right. Thank you much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Rezazadeh. There is still a lot to say about the idea of Mantaqatul Faragh and its relation to today's world. We can say some of the Muslim scholars have compared it with the theory of Masaleh Mursaleh in the Sunni school of thought. And as Dr. Rezazadeh said, the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Naini has tackled this issue in his book, Tanbihul Ummah and Tanzihul Millah, which is a very nice book. Also, some say that Sheikh Al-Ansari has also presented this idea. And Shahid Assad, in order to organize and systematize this idea, we can say, has presented in his book, Iqtisaduna. It was very kind of you. Inshallah, we'll continue
Inshallah.
Our discussion on Mantaqatul Faragh in our upcoming session of the program. And thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Do not forget to visit our website, parstoday.com/EN/Call of Islam page. Also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman.
Had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from al-mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him? Ya Mu'allim, peace be upon you, truly you are our teacher.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Even if U.S. President Joe Biden is able to overcome pressure from the military, from the CIA, and from Congress to shut Guantanamo down, justice will still be absent, not only because of the numerous lives that are forever shattered, but because America still refuses to learn from its past mistakes. Now present you an article written by Ramsey Baroud, a journalist and editor of the Palestine Chronicle. The piece is titled, Is This Who Americans Are? Gitmo is the U.S.'s Enduring Shame. The article was taken from the MintPressNews.com website. Please stay with us for more of Ramsey Baroud's article. Certainly our goal and our intention. This was the non-committal answer given by the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki when, on 12th of February, she was asked by a reporter whether the new Joe Biden administration intends to shut down the notorious prison at Guantanamo Bay by the end of the president's first term in office. Jen Psaki's answer may have seemed reassuring. The untold suffering experienced by hundreds of men in this American gulag, many of whom were surely innocent, would be finally coming to an end. However, considering the history of Guantanamo and the trail of broken promises by the Barack Obama administration, the new administration's pledge is hardly reassuring or encouraging. Compare the new language with that of Obama's impassioned diatribes about humanity, justice, and American values, which he utilized whenever he spoke of Guantanamo. Barack Obama said at a speech at the National Defense University in May of 2013, Guantanamo has become a symbol around the world for an America that flouts the rule of law. Enamored with his every word, Obama's audience clapped with enthusiasm. When he delivered that particular speech, Obama was then serving his second term in office. He already had ample opportunity to shut down the prison, which operated with no international monitoring and entirely outside the realms of international and U.S. laws. Barack Obama is likely to be remembered for his words, not his actions. Not only did he fail to shut down the prison, which was erected by his predecessor George W. Bush in 2002, but the Guantanamo industry continued to thrive during his term in office. For example, in his speech, Barack Obama made reference to the high cost of $150 million each year to imprison 166 people. According to the New Yorker magazine, reporting in 2016, Guantanamo's budget had morphed to $445 million last year when Barack Obama was still in office. Yet, as the budget grew by leaps and bounds, the number of Guantanamo prisoners dwindled. Currently, there are only 40 prisoners still residing in that massive edifice of metal, concrete, and barbed wire, located at the eastern tip of Cuba, built atop a piece of land leased by the United States back in 1903. It is easy to conclude that the U.S. government keeps the prison open only to avoid international accountability, and arguably to extract information by torture, an act that is inconsistent with American laws. But this cannot be it. On the one hand, the entire wars against Afghanistan and Iraq were illegal under international law. Such a fact hardly stopped the U.S. and its allies from savagely invading, humiliating, and torturing entire populations, with no regard whatsoever to legal and moral arguments. On the other hand, Guantanamo is merely one of many American-run prisons and detention centers throughout the world that operate with no manual of rules and according to the most ruthless tactics. The tragedy of Abu Ghraib, a U.S. military detention center near Baghdad, only became famous when direct evidence of the degrading and incredibly violent conduct that was taking place within its walls was produced and publicized. In fact, many American officials and members of Congress at the time used the Abu Ghraib scandal in 2004 as an opportunity to whitewash and rebrand American crimes elsewhere and to present the misconduct in this Iraqi prison as an isolated incident involving just a few bad apples. The few bad apples argument made by George W. Bush was more or less the same logic utilized by Barack Obama when he championed the closure of Guantanamo. Indeed, both presidents insisted that neither Abu Ghraib nor Guantanamo should be made out to represent what America is really all about. Is this who we Americans are? Barack Obama animatedly and passionately asked as he made a case in favor of the closure of Guantanamo, speaking as if he was a human rights advocate, not a commander-in-chief who had direct authority to shut down the entire facility. The truth is that the Abu Ghraib tortures were not a few bad apples, and Guantanamo is indeed a microcosm of exactly what the United States is or has become. From Bagram prison in Afghanistan to Abu Ghraib in Iraq to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba to the many floating prisons, news of which was leaked by U.S. media in 2014, the U.S. government continues to make a mockery of international and humanitarian laws. Many American officials who genuinely advocate the closure of Guantanamo refuse to acknowledge that the prison is a symbol of this, of their country's intransigence, and refuse to accept that, like any other country in the world, it is accountable to international law. This lack of accountability has exceeded the U.S. government's insistence to act alone, as in to launch wars against international mandates. One U.S. administration after another has also made it clear that under no circumstances would they allow accused war criminals to be investigated, let alone stand trial before the International Criminal Court, the ICC, at The Hague, Netherlands. The message here is that even America's bad apples can potentially walk free, regardless of the heinous crimes that they have committed. Just months after the Trump administration imposed sanctions on International Criminal Court, ICC, judges to punish them for potential investigations of U.S. crimes in Afghanistan, it freed the convicted criminals who carried out horrific crimes in Iraq. On 22nd of December, Donald Trump pardoned four American mercenaries who belonged to the private military firm Blackwater. These convicted murderers were involved in the killing of 14 Iraqi civilians, including two Iraqi children, in Baghdad in 2007. President Joe Biden fulfills his promise of shutting down Guantanamo or not, Little will change if the U.S. remains committed to its condescending attitude towards international law and to its undeserved view of itself as a country that exists above the universal rights of everyone else. That said, Guantanamo on its own is a crime against humanity, and there can never be any justification to rationalize why hundreds of people are held indefinitely, without trial and without due process, without international observers, and without ever seeing their families and loved ones. The explanation often offered by the pro-Guantanamo pundits is that the prison inmates are dangerous men. If that was the case, indeed, why were these supposed criminals not allowed to see their day in court? According to a report by Amnesty International published in May of 2020, of the 779 men who were taken to that facility, only 7 have been convicted. Worse, 5 of them were convicted as a result of pre-trial agreements under which they pleaded guilty, in return for the possibility of release from the base. According to the human rights group, such a trial by military commission did not meet fair trial standards. In other words, Guantanamo is and has always been a fraudulent operation with no real inclination to holding criminals and terrorists accountable and to preventing further crimes. Instead, Guantanamo is an industry, and a lucrative industry at that. In many ways, it is similar to the American prison military complex, ironically dubbed the criminal justice system. Referring to the unjust justice system, Human Rights Watch derided the U.S. for having the largest reported prison population in the world. Human Rights Watch stated on its website, "The U.S. criminal justice system, from policing and prosecution through to punishment, is plagued with injustices like racial disparities, excessively harsh sentencing, and drug and immigration policies that improperly emphasize criminalization." The above, too, can be considered an answer to Barack Obama's rhetorical question, "Is this who Americans are?" Yes, Mr. Obama, in fact, this is precisely who you are. While offering the world's most miserable detention conditions to hundreds of potentially innocent men, Guantanamo also offers career opportunities, high military perks and honors, and a seemingly endless budget for a small army to guard only a few shackled, gaunt-looking men in a faraway land. So even if President Joe Biden is able to overcome pressure from the military, from the CIA, and from Congress to shut down Guantanamo Bay, justice will still be absent, not only because of the numerous lives that are forever shattered, but because America still refuses to learn from its past mistakes.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.